Hello, I'm Mark Steiner. Welcome back. Good to have you all with us here today. On our way to the conversation, remind you, you're listening to the Mark Steiner Show here on WEAA 88.9 FM, celebrating the last of our summer, 88 days of summer. Details at WEAA.org. And support for WEAA is provided in part by Think About Your Eyes. More information available at thinkaboutyoureyes.com. And let's start with our day in history, and then we will jump into our conversation here with our guest about America and Syria and what the American reaction should be to Syria and the chemical weapons used in Syria. On this day in September the 6th in 1729, Moses Mendelssohn was born, a German philosopher. Important only in that this is Rosh Hashanah, and he was one of the early philosophers in Western Europe to move Judaism away from its narrow view to a broader view of society, and there was a very important figure in that period. This is the birth in 1860 of Jane Addams, American social worker, Nobel Prize laureate, who died in 1935. This is the day that Korzhak Zhvarsky designed the Crazy Horse Memorial that's built in South Dakota. This is the day that Leander J. Shaw, Jr., justice in the Florida Supreme Court since 1983, became in 1990 the first African was born, became the first African-American Chief Justice in Florida and the second African-American Chief Justice in any Supreme Court. This is a day that a man who wants to be president was born, Chris Christie, governor of New Jersey, was born in 1962. Sounds like it's too young to be president to me. this is a day in 1967 that Macy Gray was born, one of my favorite singers, songwriter and actress as well. And Foxy Brown, the American rapper, was born on this day in 1979. Luciano Pavarotti, the great Italian tenor, died in 2007, as did the man who brought the Ravens to us, Art Modell, who died in 2012. Didn't do so well last night, his Ravens, but there it is. This is the day in 1620 that the Pilgrims set off from Plymouth, England, to end up in America, to take the lands away from the native people when they got here and create a new world in the United States, what became the U.S. This is the day in 1628, Puritans settled Salem, and in 1847, Henry David Thoreau left Walden Pond to move into Ralph Waldo Emerson in 1847. And this is in 1826 that John Brown Russworm became the first African-American to graduate from college on September 6, 1826, from Bowdoin College. And this was 14 days before Edward Jones graduated from Amherst, become the second African-American to graduate in a wave of graduates that took place in 1826, but began something very important. In 1865, Thaddeus Stevens, the powerful radical Republican congressman, urged the confiscation of all estates of Confederate leaders and the distribution of land to adult freedmen in 40-acre plots, a promise never kept. This is the day in 1870, Louisa Ann Swain was born in Laramie, Wyoming, became the first woman in the United States to cast a vote legally in 1807. What's interesting about that very quickly is that the right to vote campaign that took place in Wyoming was led by the polygamous wives of Mormons. They led the fight for women's rights in Wyoming, which is an interesting part of our history. This was a day in 1876. There was a movement that was afoot in the South after the Civil War, the Redemption Movement, to move African-Americans and Republicans out of power. They created a war in South Carolina that became a huge war, where armed blacks and whites had battles, raging battles, over this. They created a Black Democratic Club, which were black front people for the white supremacists of the South, to take over. A war ensued. The federal troops pulled away. And the former Confederate troops eventually defeated African-American freedom fighters in what we call a race riot, but was actually a war that began the end of Reconstruction. This was the day that in 1892 that George Little Chocolate Dixon beat Jack Skelly in New Orleans, becoming to win the featherweight title of the first African-American to do so. The New Orleans Times-Democrat wrote that day, "It's a mistake to match a Negro and a white man to bring the races together in any terms of equality, even in the prize ring." But little Chocolate Dixon had a different – something else up for him. He won. This is a day that Leon Schlagisch shoots and fatally wounded President McKinley in 1901.
Coal Guts.
Thank you very much. Thank you. This is the day that Rayford Johnson became the first African-American to win the decathlon in the Olympics. The day in 1966 in Cape Town when Prime Minister Hendrik Verwoerd my African correspondent here. Verwoerd was stabbed and died. He was one of the architects of apartheid in the South African Parliament in 1966. This is the day in 1970 when two jets were hijacked by the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine and taken to Dawson's Field in Jordan. And 2 years later, this is where 9 Israeli athletes were taken hostage at the Munich Olympic Games because of that moment in history 2 years before and were killed by the Black September group of Palestinians. Two other Israelis were also slain that day. This is a day in 1986 in Istanbul. Two terrorists from Abu Nidal's organization blew up a synagogue, the Neve Shalom, a synagogue doing Shabbat services in Istanbul, killing 22 people. And this is the day in 1995 that Cal Ripken of the Orioles played his 2,131st consecutive game, breaking the record that stood for 56 years. And this is also the day in 1997 that over 1 million people lined the streets and 2.5 billion people watched TV as Diana, Princess of Wales, was buried. So welcome to our show today, folks. We are going to take a look today at Syria. We have with us in the studio a student colleague who corrected my pronunciation on two things during the day in history, veteran public radio journalist who's covered wars and the Middle East in Middle East and Africa for many years and was founder of the Cairo Bureau for NPR. Dr. Adil Shamu is with us, associate fellow of the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, D.C., senior analyst of Foreign Policy and Focus, author of Equal Worth, When Humanity Will Have Peace, Imara Jones, economic justice contributor for ColorLines.com, who served in the Clinton White House, and Joseph Amadeo, who is an ethics and policy researcher, Carnegie New Leader at the Carnegie Council for Ethics in International Affairs, and wrote a piece for Huffington Post entitled, We Have an Ethical Obligation to Intervene in Syria. And all of you there out there listening at 410-319-8888, write to us here at SteinerShow@gmail.com. And you can log on to our Facebook pages and also tweet us at Mark Steiner, your thoughts on what America should do, what should be our response to Syria. And let's start with Joseph Amadeo. Is it Amadeo? Do I have that right?
Amadeo, yes.
Good, yeah. Amadeo. Welcome to the show for the first time, Joseph. Good to have you with us.
Great. Thank you for having me.
Okay. All that intro is done. I can slow down and ask the question. And the question is that you wrote a piece about our ethical obligation to go into Syria using Rwanda as an example of what we failed to do once before when 1 million people were killed in a genocidal war. And as I was reading the article, what struck me, Joseph, whether you can talk about it a bit, was that Rwanda and Syria are two very different places and two very different times in history. And some people might think this is a huge leap to make, suggesting Western African troops can go into Rwanda is not the same as the West going into Syria. So talk about a bit about that.
Sure, absolutely. I mean, I think that the important thing to note about Rwanda is, you know, there is obviously a U.S. absence. Or there was a U.S. absence in regards to the crisis that led to 500,000 to 1 million individuals being killed. What I do think is important to note, though, is that after the Rwandan crisis, there really was an international movement to ascertain a doctrine that would replace the right to intervene with sort of the responsibility to protect. And this is important because I think this really provides an interesting means by which we can use Rwanda as an example to understand why we should go into Syria, specifically because we as the international community have an ethical obligation, as I said in my article, to intervene in cases where states are failing to protect their citizens. Not only are they failing to protect their citizens, but in the case of Syria, as in the case of Rwanda, they're actually the culprit that is utilizing crimes against humanity to sort of pressure their citizens into a situation where really they're taking away their rights. And so in my opinion, and frankly, I think that responsibility to protect, again, a UN initiative which was affirmed under several UN resolutions, including a resolution of the UN Security Council, speaks very clearly to the fact that when peaceful peaceful measures fail, we as the global community have to go in, if necessary, by military intervention to secure and preserve and restore the rights of those individuals to ensure that crimes against humanity are not allowed to happen like they did in Rwanda and Kosovo and earlier examples from the 20th century. So I do think that we have an ethical obligation, and I do think that Rwanda is a viable example because it demonstrates what happens when we're not involved, even though there was some late intervention there. But I think that we really need to start looking at it through that lens to truly understand what we're considering here in Syria. And I also think it's worth noting, you know, this Syrian crisis is not new, right? You know, we're talking about a government that in 2011, the UN High Commissioner on Human Rights, specifically through an independent inquiry, went to Syria and attempted to at least investigate claims against crimes against humanity. And the Syrian government kept sort of walking away from the table and not giving the UN and the independent inquiry the opportunity to really conduct its investigation in a way in which it could have either ruled, yes, there are crimes against humanity, or there's not. So I think that we've learned from the past, from both economic sanctions as well as these peaceful opportunities, that Syria doesn't respond.
Now, I want two in-studio guests to come in here very fast before we turn to Amara Jones. And let me start first with your response to that, Adil. And then I was interested in the blog you wrote just last night, Sunni, which was a real attack on the Assad regime and how frightening a place Syria is to live in even before this war started. But, Adil, what's your response to what Joseph said?
Well, Joseph, I teach ethics. I have been teaching it for over 20 years at a medical school. And there is something called lack of integrity of the West. It's like a little flag. They use it as a ruse whenever the humanitarian intervention suits their need. And in this case, is very clear that their interest, their regional interest and their global interest, is to occupy and influence the policies of our allies in the Middle East. We did not raise ire, and I'm not sure whether you did or not, that when we, the United States, used depleted uranium in Iraq, when we lied about weapons of mass destruction, and when the Israelis used white phosphorus, which is prohibited by the Geneva Convention on the Hamas-Gaza Strip war, which was not really a war, was a slaughter, was one-sided. And this selective morality lacks integrity. That's the problem with R2P, and that's a right to protect. It's a ruse. We have used it in Iraq with an incredible outcome, horrendous outcome of 200,000 to 300,000 people killed, 500,000 wounded, 70,000 orphans, and a million more, 4.5 million displaced. And I didn't hear the moral outrage from many people now they are talking about. I supported in the first 6 months the Syrian uprising. The problem is that the uprising was hijacked by our allies, the Saudis and the Qataris, by $6 to $7 billion infusion of money into the Syrian rebel, who are mostly Al-Qaeda and the like in Syria. The secular component of the uprising has almost vanished. That is, moral consistency is very important in ethical decision-making process, which is lacking.
Sunni, then we'll turn to Amari.
I agree. I mean, this is what we were talking about before. But the real sad part is that this is not a civil war, a Syrian civil war. It is a war taking place in Syria by other parties. It's a proxy war. That's what it has devolved to. And that's really the saddest part. Now, I've heard a lot of talk about, you know, we can bring this Assad, this regime, into negotiations. But I've talked to some people who negotiate. And anyone who knows anything about that regime has to know that this is a Machiavellian, maximalist regime. They will talk to you. And I was talking with some U.S. diplomats. They talked about Assad, about the old man. When the old man was there, he would bring them to Damascus. He would talk. Actually, what he would do is he would lecture for hours our secretaries of states, our presidents. He would lecture them for hours, and it became like a test of wills. Or more or less a test of bladders, because the old man would sit in his chair, and it was almost like a sign of weakness, like G. Gordon Liddy holding his hand over an open flame. He would go on with these lectures, and he would force our diplomats to have to stop so that they could use the bathroom. But this, the will of this regime and of the Assads to hold power regardless. If they have to destroy Syria to control it, they will do so. And I don't think that people in this part of the world have a proper appreciation of the true nature of that family and the true nature of this regime, that there will be no negotiation, there will be no deal other than the deal that they want to take. If Syria has to be destroyed, so be it. And I don't think there's an appreciation of that. Or if we have these chemical attacks, people do not have an idea of how ugly this could get. This could get, like I said, Damascus could resemble Dresden or Berlin after World War II if this thing keeps going on.
So, Imara, I'm curious, when you look at, since you were in the White House on Capitol Hill, now let's switch this for a moment and then we'll jump into the fray with all the broad issues you've raised here. What's happening in Congress at the moment? And it seems a very complex mixture of, there's a huge anti-war fervor in America that is very complex. The kind of more conservative elements that were rah-rah under Bush to attack Afghanistan instead of the war and push the war in Iraq, now don't want us to be in Syria. The anti-war progressive side of the Democratic world is against the war, though it's really interesting to watch the Progressive Caucus kind of teetering and tottering, being afraid to stand up and say what they really think, which I find really interesting, including our two local congressmen here, a part of the caucus, Congressman Cummings and Congressman Edwards. And Congressman Sarbanes, who's not part of the caucus. But so what is your take on that dynamic politically, Imara?
Well, I think what's interesting is the degree to which there is a full court press on Syria, unlike we've seen on very few issues from this White House. One of the things that I wrote about is that it would be terrific to have seen the same sort of a push on some key economic issues that continue to dog the country, such as turning back sequestration. In just 4 weeks, the United States government is going to run out of money unless Congress passes a budget. There are only 9 legislative days to do that. If 3 or 4 of them are taken up by Syria, that means they only have 4 days to pass a budget. The same is true for the budget. The same is true for health care. The same is true for immigration. You know, this sort of push wasn't seen even on the president's own jobs bill. There's a full court press by this administration. It's very rare that on every single vote of force that I'd ever seen and ever on any vote of military authorization I've ever seen, initially there's always reticence by members of Congress, but normally the president is able to get what the president needs because the president is commander-in-chief. I don't know. I think right now the question is up in the air as to whether or not that's actually going to be the case, given the dynamics in the House and given the dynamics in the Senate. But yes, progressives are coming under a tremendous amount of pressure. There was a report yesterday that the Congressional Black Caucus has been targeted by the administration to keep quiet on this issue, which is also disturbing. And so that's where those dynamics are. And it's anybody's guess right now as to whether or not the president is going to be able to get the votes that he needs. It's not for certain at all. And I think for me, one of the interesting things about this that I mentioned or wrote about earlier this week is that for me, I actually initially supported greater involvement in Syria, and I supported the strikes. I don't support the strikes because of humanitarian reasons for all of the issues of moral consistency that were raised before. I think you either have to do it or you don't. My motivation was strictly on whether or not it was in the United States' interest for us to live in a world where the use of weapons of mass destruction become the norm. And my answer to that is no, it's not in the interest of the United States. And I supported the strikes until the resolution, because what the resolution signals to me is that the administration actually foresees the possibility of a wider war, which is why they want wider authorization. Because under existing law, under the War Powers Act, the president has the ability to deploy the armed forces of the United States to strike anywhere in the world for up to 60 days without congressional authority. If this were to be a limited operation, then the president has the ability to be able to execute that. Presidents normally have only introduced resolutions backing or authorizing force from Congress over the past 50 years when they foresee a wider war, as in Vietnam, as in both wars in Iraq, and also in Afghanistan. And so that has led me to not support this strike. I believe that it's horrible that we've gotten to this place, that we either have to choose the allowance of chemical weapons or do nothing. But I think that right now we're at the stage where there's a likelihood of the lack of congressional authority, and even if they do, the intervention is going to make things a lot worse.
And I would say that we have a whole hour we could discuss whether or not the constitutionality of the War Powers Act. I think there's a lot of argument about in this country. It has not been tested really in the Supreme Court yet. It needs to be, I think, because that's the discussion this country has to have. But so what should be the response of the United States then? What should be the response of the world, of this country, Are we unilaterally the policemen of the world? What should be the response to Assad? What is a response when things like this happen? 100,000 dead, chemical weapons used. What should we do? Adel.
Well, it's a proxy civil war. And this is why I said there is no moral consistency. When our allies, the Saudis, we said nothing as long as they're killing this proxy war to the last Syrian, basically. That's how we do it. We were just happy watching killing each other. And we were, by the way, training and helping and giving humanitarian assistance, which I supported the humanitarian assistance. But I enunciated 6 months after the uprising some principles the West should declare that they will abide by. For example, we will not occupy this country, that we will not interfere in their election process, that we will protect minorities, et cetera, et cetera, that we will not allow billions of dollars of the Saudis coming into fueling the fire. Let me give you today in New York Times, there was a lengthy article about Israel's policy, what it is, towards Syria. It's a very fascinating and illustrating the point. Basically, the Israeli analyst said, we want the Syrians to bleed each other to death. They have really, this is their policy. So they're supporting 100%, and AIPAC is doing it, supporting Obama's policy. Bomb, but not bomb enough to get rid of Assad and not to strengthen the opposition.
So what should be the response is the question.
The response is this is a civil war. We should stay out of it because whenever the West has gone into the recent one, have resulted in occupation and harming the other people. We are not clean moral judges in this war. We are not. We have interest.
So in the 2 minutes, we have about 3 minutes before we have to take a break here, but you can lead that into it, Joseph, if you would. I mean, I understand what you're saying about ethical obligations in this world, but until 3 months ago, British firms were supplying chemicals to the Assad government to make the weapons. We supplied the chemicals needed for Saddam to do it when he attacked the Kurds and the Iranians. So how do we determine what ethically we should be doing here?
I mean, I think you raise a very fair point. I mean, the one thing I will say is I'll agree with one of the other guests in saying the world is morally bankrupt to some extent, right? I mean, I don't think that anyone's going to contend otherwise. However, I do think that as a global community, as a country, frankly, as a global institution, the UN, has to move beyond the tests of the past in terms of the Iraq test, the Vietnam test, and we have to actually start doing things for the right reasons. Am I saying, you know, that we probably should be, you know, supporting the individuals in the Congo who are being victims of crimes against humanity? Absolutely. But I'm saying that what's on the table at this moment, Syria, right, this is a situation where we need to go in. And I think that the reason we have to go in is because we have to start telling the world, frankly, that we believe that a human life is viable no matter where it is.
Okay, so I'm sorry to interrupt. My apologies for interrupting you. We have to take a very brief one-minute break and come back. When you come back, I want you to pick up and talk about what that means to go in. What do you mean we should go in? And Suni wants to say something to respond to that. I should come back after that. We'll be right back as we look at what America should do with Syria. 410-319-8888. I see Aaron is our first caller up. We'll be back in a minute. Welcome back. We're looking at what America's response to Syria should be here on the Mark Steiner Show in this next half an hour. We are here with Suni Khaled, veteran public radio journalist who's covered the Middle East and Africa extensively, Dr. Adel Shamu, associate fellow, and speaks Arabic fluently. Dr. Adel Shamu, associate fellow of the Institute of Policy Studies in Washington, D.C., senior analyst with Foreign Policy and Focus, who also speaks fluent Arabic because that's where he's from, Iraq. Imara Jones, economic justice contributor for ColorLines.com, served in the Clinton White House. Joseph Amadeo, ethics and policy researcher. Carnegie, new leader at the Carnegie Council for Ethics and International Affairs, who wrote a really provocatively interesting piece called We Have an Ethical Obligation to Intervene in Syria. 410-319-8888 is the number here. We have a lot of callers calling in. Joseph, so define for us, though, quickly, if you could, what that response looks like. What does that mean to go into Syria? What do you mean by that?
Sure. I mean, I don't mean a physical on-the-boots presence, obviously, one that would be at odds with the resolution that came out of the Senate committee. But I do think that we have a very sound example of what we could do in Syria in terms of looking back at the Kosovo intervention, 78-day bombardment that resulted in a pretty significant destabilization and put really Kosovo on the road to sort of at least somewhat of established peace. There were no Western casualties. It cost $5 billion, which is roughly, what, 1/1,000th of what the war in Iraq cost. And I think really that's what we need. It also had no congressional approval, which is worth noting. And also really no UN approval. So I think that in terms of the situation in Syria, we could use that as a potential example of what we could do. And actually, State Department officials and even DOD officials have sort of been cited in the Wall Street Journal and New York Times as saying that that is a viable option. In terms of providing some type of a plan. So I do think that that's the intervention that I foresee taking place. I think that's the intervention that, frankly, is limited to taking place based on the U.S. Senate's committee resolution.
Quick response to it, and then I'm going to go to the phones.
The Hippocratic Oath. Hippocratic Oath is first do no harm. How can you go into that situation and do no harm? The other thing is blowback. Kosovo, that situation, they were in the Balkans.
That's right.
We're not talking about neighbors next door. You have Jordan, which has 1 million refugees. You have Lebanon, which has 1 million refugees. You have Hezbollah. You have the Israelis. And you have
Iraq.
Iraq. And you have Iran. You have borders which are permeable. You have paramilitary and military organizations with missiles and other heavy weaponry. My concern is that, okay, if the United States goes in and launches cruise missiles and does some bombing, that's fine. Is the other side going to stay passive? I don't think so. The Lebanese are actually worried. They have 1 million refugees. Beirut is awash with refugees. They are concerned that if the Americans make any kind of military strike, there are 5,000 refugees coming over a day, coming over the border, that their refugee population within a couple of weeks could go from 1 million to more than 2 million.
Let me open the phones and come right back to our other two guests who have not had a say in this part of our show, Imara Jones and Dr. Adil Shamu. 410-319-8888. Aaron, you're on the air.
Good morning, Mr. Steiner.
Good morning, Aaron.
Two quick comments for all or any one of your guests today. First comment is, what are the contingencies for America and its citizens to prepare for the pushback that's going to come when America makes a aggressive move? And second, America being roughly 237 years old, give or take, there's no record of any sympathy or moral action taken by the Americans or any of their allies towards anyone of indigenous population outside of themselves. So those are my two comments.
Adil, let me take first shot and go to Amara and go back to the phones.
Well, I'm sure the U.S. government is taking some contingency plans. But as you know, any plan falls apart once they're the start of a war. The Obama administration claimed we are not going to war. We're going to bomb them. General Dempsey said it's a declaration of war.
Who's General Dempsey?
Martin Dempsey, the Chairman of the Joint Chief of Staff.
Okay, that's who, of course that's who it is. Yeah. Well, my brain was gone for a minute. I'm sorry.
not Jack Dempsey.
Sorry about that. He took my seat right there.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
So I'm saying is there is so much what I call it misrepresentation of the facts in order to roost the American people in supporting this. What do you mean? It's a declaration of war. You're going to bomb them, and they're going to try to bomb you in different ways because they don't have our means. They don't have Tomahawk missiles. They don't have drones. They don't have airplanes. What they will do is use terrorist activity. So I believe there will be an increase in terrorist activities in our interest in the Middle East. Yeah, I mean, there will be. This is known.
Imara, how would you respond to that very quickly before we go back?
Well, I think the question underscores the overall problem on one particular aspect of it, but the general aspect is that there hasn't been a plan on Syria. The problem with with the problem with Syria and the problem with the Middle East right now is that there is no active plan for the United States with regards to diplomacy of what we see the political future to look like, because military force only means something when it has political ends. And I was in the administration during the wars in Kosovo, and one of the most important things about that is that there was an active diplomatic engagement on creating a political solution that was then backed up by force. That's also doubly true for Bosnia. The problem with the United States right now, you know, as Brent Scowcroft and Chris Hill actually pointed out yesterday, there is no active diplomatic fan for Syria. And one of the reasons why the situation has become a proxy war, one of the reasons why all of the allies of the United States have intervened, is because of the absence of U.S. leadership and the absence of U.S. Active engagement, not passive engagement, but active engagement to try to come up with the right solutions. And one of the reasons why the Russians are frustrated with the United States, quite frankly, is because there hasn't been that. They don't see what an endgame is politically that will allow them to be able continue to be engaged in the Middle East if we move forward. And so there's a huge vacuum here with regards to a lack of a political plan, a plan for how we're going to deal with blue-black, a whole host of things. And that's what's most shocking, because the fact that we got to this point is not that great of a surprise. The Assad regime has used chemical weapons almost 36 times over the last year. We were going to get to a point where we were going to have to make some sort of a decision. And the fact that there isn't a broad-scale plan for what we're going to do is a part of the problem, and why intervention probably is not a good idea right now.
We have somebody who wrote in, Sheldon, and then I'll let our other two guests kind of respond to this for a minute. Sheldon writes in that there's no legal basis for an attack to Syria. The United States is not subject to a Syrian attack, and Security Council will not authorize U.S. attack. They are the only two bases for laws to initiate a military assault on another country under international law. Chemical warfare is abhorrent. U.S. lacks moral authority, given that we use chemical weapons to deplete uranium in Iraq, and condone use of the chemical weapons against Iran by Iraq. And I have to read. I can't read all this. It was a great piece you wrote here, Sheldon, but much too long for me to read all in the air. And the third, the probability of serious negative blowback from a U.S. attack is extremely high. Almost certain some combination of Syria, Hezbollah, and Iran will retaliate against U.S. forces in the area or against Israel or somewhere. Limited targeting will not work, given Al-Qaeda and its allies now constitute the majority of the hostile opposition to Assad. And finally, he writes, a case can be made for U.S. involvement in Syria, which, as I brought on the show before in these conversations, that involvement can include increased humanitarian aid to refugees, including granting refugee status and visas to Syrians interested in coming to the U.S. and entering into serious negotiations with Russia to attempt to limit the civil war. But a military strike under the guise of punishing Assad is precisely the wrong response for legal, moral, pragmatic, and economic reasons. Joseph Abadeo.
Yeah, I mean, I think that one thing I want to point out that's actually really important in what he just said is about refugees. And I think that's, again, an example of moral bankruptcy. You know, the United States over the past years has only accepted 90 Syrian refugees. Now, all of a sudden, in early August, we're talking about saying, oh, we'll accept 2,000 of the most vulnerable. I think that's, frankly, you know, of concern, and that should be reviewed by the international community and looked into. But I want to talk about one other thing that he said, which is saying that the U.S. does not have the right under international law for unilateral intervention. I don't think that's totally accurate, because the U.N. Charter, Article 2.4, actually only prohibits actions taken by individual states that are in regard to the territorial integrity or the political independence of the state intervened by another state. I think in this case, with humanitarian intervention, we're not going in for and attacking the territorial integrity or the political independence. Rather, we're going in for the purposes under, again, I'll go back to R2P, we're going back in and we're saying that we're going in to secure the rights of the individuals who are in that territory.
But so we're not, though. Unique. We're just we're lobbing missiles. How is that doing that?
Are we secure? Are we going to secure the rights of the Christians and the Alawis as well? Because whatever happens with anyone else, the bloodletting that is accompanying this civil war is only the dress rehearsal for the bloodletting and score settling that's going to take place with that regime where the Syrian state collapses. Are we prepared to protect all of the various ethnic groups, sectarian groups in Syria? I don't think so.
I have a different take than Joseph has, and that is I think Ban Ki-moon knows the UN Secretary General, better than Joseph. And he declared there are only those two you cited, Mark, the legal basis of interfering in Syria. And he said it will be in violation of international law. So Ban Ki-moon, the UN Secretary General, should know what the international law. Now, we waive the international law whenever it's convenient. Syria, by the way, is not violating international law. That's why the president changed his tune. He calls it they are violating international norms. Well, international norms, he declares what they are, the international norms. I am not supporting chemical weapons. I don't want the chemical weapons to be used anywhere, neither nuclear weapon, neither white phosphorus and depleted uranium. But this is the selective morality which makes the people, the average people, and they're wise when they have the information, in opposing any interference.
The other thing that's affected our credibility is what's happening in the region with the drone attacks, and also what's happening in Cairo, where you had that the military-backed government came in and murdered 1,000 people who were peacefully protesting in Nasser, at the Rabah al-Adawiyah. And we said nothing. We won't even declare the White House won't even declare it a coup.
So let me let this come back in here. Let go to the phones and come right back to Joseph and Amara. 410-319-8888. Mike, you're on the air.
Good morning, folks.
Good morning, Mike.
Chris Hedges, who I know you guys know who he is. He's in the Nation Institute.
Chris Hedges, the commentator, right? Go ahead.
Oh, yeah, Chris.
As he put it, there's no real evidence been offered that the Assad government did the deed. It was done. Was it done by Saudi Arabia? I don't know. And those who know ain't talking. And to accept the moral posturing of the United States government is, it's not naive, it's dishonest.
So, and so let me turn to Imara and then quickly to Joseph and then we've got the phones. What's your response to Mike, Imara?
I mean, two quick things. One, I disagree with him. I think that no one disputes that this chemical attack happened. The second thing is that what we know historically in terms of the scale, the delivery systems that are needed, the expertise that's needed, because sarin, you have to mix it specially before, and only forces that are trained to do that can do that, and just the sheer amount of materials that you need to do this are only in the possession of the Syrian government. And that is what we know historically, and so there is a really strong circumstantial evidence, probably 90%, that this was on the part of the Syrian government. There are reports privately, by the way, that the Russians don't dispute that. They're disputing it publicly, but privately to the U.S., they don't dispute it at all. One thing I wanted to just mention as well, Mark, really quickly, is that the debate here, I think, is a little bit false. I don't believe that the choice is between doing nothing and doing something. I think that there is a middle way here, and that is, one, come up with a political plan that for Syria that is serious and that has backing and provides a way forward, which we don't have. Actively negotiate with the Russians on what trade-offs they're willing to make in order to bring peace there. Implement a region-wide push to roll back the different actors, or at least to coordinate the support that's going to the rebels, that's happening on an up and down basis. And fourthly, for the United States to do probably what it should have done over the last year, and that's actually give the Syrian rebels the firepower that they need in order to win their own freedom. We have a pretty good idea of who the people are that are on our side versus who are not on our side. They're actually not in the same territory, so the rebels in the FSA that are supportive of, are more moderate or supportive of our interests, we know where they are physically versus the Al-Qaeda and al-Nusra fighters. So there's a lot that we can do that we're not doing, and one of the reasons why we've ended up in this stark sort of, I would argue, false choice is because we haven't actually done the things that are already in our writ to make the situation different.
And so I know both of you want to respond very quickly to that.
Very quickly, there are consensus that there are over 100 groups in Syria fighting against Assad, and there is no, they have no unified command and control structure. So there is, I mean, your statement that we know who they are, that's really just doesn't bear it out by those people who've been on the ground as well as they have contact in Syria.
Can I just respond to that?
Very quickly, because we have very little bit of time left, Imara.
Please go ahead. That estimated 100,000 fighters, 80% of them, only 20% of them are in al-Nusra or al-Qaeda, and they are physically in different parts of the country. The CIA has been mapping those groups for the last year on the ground. We have a pretty good idea of who we should give arms to and where they are.
410-319-8888. Let's go to Bryn, then we'll go to Suni and Joseph, and we might have to round this out because we have another group coming in here. Bryn, you're on the air. Bryn, you there? Hello, Bryn? You're on the air? Can you hear us?
Hello?
You're on the air, Bryn. Go ahead.
Oh, it's not Bryn. It's Fran.
Oh, it says Bryn on my screen. I apologize.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
Okay. I just want to make one point, and that is I feel there's almost an onion effect here where we keep unlayering problems. It seems we've got to start reframing this into, first of all, something about the weapons that we're talking about. And one of the ways to do that is to reframe our approach to the United Nations, trying to get the UN to look at how will we secure these weapons so that they cannot be used again, instead of saying, jumping to the military solutions. I think we would have much more support in the United Nations for that approach, because everyone has a stake in that, instead of jumping to the military where everybody runs away from it because they don't want to get caught up in a quagmire again. And I feel that the public would be better served if we were talking about solving this problem first and then looking to other solutions. Our credibility is very bad right now. I mean, we're using drones. How can we say that we have moral credibility?
Adel.
Well, I think she has a good suggestion. As a matter of fact, Senator Joe Manchin from Virginia, West Virginia, and he said, why don't we give Assad 45 days to sign the non-proliferation of the chemical weapon treaty, and then if he agrees to it, then we will have UN forces to go and secure the chemical weapon depots. It's a reasonable suggestion. I don't want them to use chemical weapon. Plus, I'm not sure really. I think I could believe it he used it, but I'm not sure that some other rogue group.
Ustez, how likely would it be for Bashar al-Assad to agree to anything, or to number one, to agree to those terms, or to agree to implementation? People have to know the true nature of this regime. These are really bad guys.
Oh, absolutely.
These are really bad guys.
They're a mafia family. So, I'm with you.
So let me have a quick 30-second response here from Joseph, and then we'll close out one of our guests in the studio. Go ahead.
Sure. No, I mean, I think that, the caller actually, I agree with actually Adil and the caller. I think that we need to look at some serious reformation at the UN, both in terms of the Chemical Weapons Convention and how we actually, sort of implement that and ensure that it's held out to. I also think that we need to start looking at the UN Security Council and realizing that we have some significant absent players who have a very significant role in the international community who don't have veto power and, frankly, don't have a significant voice on the council itself. So I think those are real issues that we need to start discussing. In terms of the intervention, I think that Bashar al-Assad has demonstrated that his unwillingness to participate in international peaceful efforts to sort of restore the rights to his people, specifically again in 2011, and his unwillingness to participate in the UN High Commission on Human Rights inquiry.
If you could guarantee me that we are not going to occupy him and we're not going to make the people have no voice in their own government for the next decade or two once we interfere and the Saudis interfere. You could never promise me that's what's going to turn out to be.
I think that you raise the point that's important is that we keep going back to what the U.S. has done in the past. The question I have is,
well, what makes us think they're going to do anything different in the future?
Now. They're doing it now.
But when are we going to look to the future and realize?
But they're doing it now.
Right.
Gentlemen, let me just say we are just out of time here. And I'm sorry we have to cut this segment now. This is deeply important. I want to encourage all of our listeners to go to www.steinershow.org. We have listed there the contact information for both the senators, all the congressmen, also folks in Delaware and Pennsylvania, to contact their congressional representatives. Let them know how you feel about this action being voted on this week. It's critically important that you participate at least that way to have your voice heard. You can copy us at steinershow@gmail.com when you send that email. Let us know how you're thinking and feeling. Write to your congressional representatives. Let them know. As we head along into another war situation from the United States. So from our own country, within our own country. I want to thank SUNY College once again for being in studio. Dr. Adel Shamu, always great to have you here.
Thank you.
Amara Jones, thank you again for your time. Always great to have you with us. Joseph.
Thanks.
Joseph Amadeo, wonderful to meet you on the air with us. I look forward to having you back with us.
Thanks very much.
Thank you all so
thank
much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
We're going to take a very brief break, and then when we come back, we will be talking to folks from the City Paper about their latest piece on slumlords. Stay with us.